right? So I have here the source. I have here the terms that will get me to how do I accomplish that mitzvah. And by the way, you got me onto something that which I have here in the next source, which I have here just Ibn Ezra, just to show you different schools of thought. That is, remember, I'm giving you here the Rambam. I'm not here in any way telling you that the Rambam is the be-all and end-all of the universe. There are very, very different models that we have. So I'm not going to tell you, and if I'm arguing with you, or if I'm arguing with, let's say, somebody from the Orthodox or Haredi world, I will never say, this is the truth. Right? This is Das Yechidi, this is one school of thought. If you look at the other, to me, the other major, major figure, there are, to me, two of the giants, and everybody else kind of falls, I think, a number of levels below them, which is the Rambam and the Ramban. There are no two greater Rishonim than them. And the Ramban offers you a completely, and maybe you will have a course once on the Ramban, but the Ramban offers you a completely different model of Judaism. But just to... yeah, sorry.
I just want to clarify something you said, because you say that from what we just read, that there is an imperative to have the Bible University study. What do you mean by that? Because I can sort of see somebody seeing God or first cause from a very spiritualistic, a child being taught every day there's a God, and he sees God in the world, and maybe in a much more pure way. So why is that?
I agree with it. I can see that too. I can see that too. Okay, I can see that too. I can see that too. It's a different model. It's not the Rambam's model.
How are you reading?
Well, what I'm trying to build up, the meaning of mada, the terms that I just told you that he's using, okay, the term leda, right? All these things do not point to the model that you raise. I'm not saying that's not a valid model.
I'm just saying, again, I'm just trying to understand. It's from the words
leda. All these words have very, very technical meaning. Okay, you know what? Hold up, and I'm trying to build up the argument, so maybe I'll be more convincing as I end off. But again, I'm not in any way disparaging that model, and that is a model, and maybe the next source will respond to that somewhat. That is, remember, the Rum. Yeah, sorry, Lee.
Sorry, just by building up your argument, I just want to throw this into the mix. With all due respect to Aristotle and 1400 years of acceptance of his position and the principle of infinite progression, once you get it, you get it. Right? I mean, the model's relatively simple. Once you work back to a first cause and that's the direction you're going in, you get it. Why do you have to spend years and years and years studying that? Spend 15 minutes getting the principle and you know it.
Okay. So you studied the one of the books, right? So when he talks about the existence of God, you know, if you go to section 2 of the guide is divided into three sections. I don't know if you read it. Like, I kind of went through it. I got like really a headache. But he goes through, you know, 25 premises, right? These things are in his time, okay? In his time, using the science of his time, we've now expanded this, okay? He's building on a knowledge of the world, okay? A knowledge of, first of all, preliminary sciences like math and logic, right? And then a science of the world. Aristotle. Now we've expanded that far beyond these confines. So you cannot know, right? You extrapolate to God from the world, right? You're extrapolating from God to the world. From the world to God. The only way I can possibly extrapolate from the world to God is by understanding the world in every facet, every dimension.
Well,
he had the luxury, and to be fair to us today, science was much more narrow, so he had the luxury to probably know everything there was to know in his time. Now it's impossible, right? Somebody can spend his entire life learning the reproductive system of a flea. Okay, you can spend your entire life doing that. So it's not that easy. It's not that easy, right?
It's not that easy.
And as known.
What do you mean, know what's known?
Well, meaning that you said in his world there was only so much science, now we have this much. You can, you know, achieve whatever you need to achieve, but by knowing what's out there, and what's out there then was this, this, and now it's this, knowing what was out there was sufficient to make you know what you needed to know.
But the Rambam wouldn't say, look, everybody judges their where they stand, right? So for them, their science was science. I mean, he demonstrated. I want to make the point here that it's not, to me, it's not all that important the details and whether the science was wrong or not. What's important here is the method. By which you accomplish a mitzvah. Okay? Right? The method by which you accomplish a mitzvah is not simply to go around and say, right here, how do you accomplish the mitzvah here? Have we accomplished the mitzvah by all going out and saying, I know God exists? Have we accomplished the mitzvah?
Well,
if I just say, you know what, I know God exists, without thinking about it, without studying, without proving demonstrably that God exists. Okay, this is problematic, and since the philosopher Immanuel Kant has kind of shown that this is impossible. However, all I want to point out is the importance of working at it, of working towards a final demonstration. For the Rambam, here the mitzvah entails many, many years of work.
Well, it's the action of learning, I think, from the Rambam's, one of the points of view of the Rambam, the action of learning that makes you knowing, allows you to know.
Right.
If you just accepted it, you don't really know.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So, and all the study, I mean, don't forget, the Rambam, we know what the Rambam studied. We have letters from the Rambam. Most importantly, we have letters. I told you about a letter to Ibn Tibbon. He also wrote a letter to Ibn Tibbon about the things that Ibn Tibbon was the translator of the Mordechai from Arabic, Judeo-Arabic to Hebrew. And so remember last week he couldn't meet with him because he had that busy schedule. But he wrote him a guide and he said, these are the things that you have to know before you read my thing. Those don't come just I know it, right? You have to read all the Islamic philosophers, Al-Farabi, Avicenna, Averroes, all these guys are great interpreters of Aristotle. Again, the actual guys involved, the actual players, are not that important. But in order to understand what I write, you have to know all this stuff. That's right. You have to struggle. So for instance, when he talks about, just apropos your question, when he talks about knowing things and what knowledge entails. He asks, if anybody wants to look at the Guide to the Perplexed, chapters, let's say 32 to 34, 35, 36. There he talks about various levels of knowledge. At the bottom of the scale, at the very, very bottom of the scale, is Mesorah. Okay? I'm giving it that name. I just want it to be kind of controversial. But in fact, that's what it is. That is that people who, I don't want to read explicitly what he says here about people, but people who at the very, very lowest level, and we need this because from what I've just described, there will probably be very few people that end up actually accomplishing this mitzvah, and that's probably true. But at the very least, we need people to know these things. And probably that's why he developed the Yud Gimel Ikarim. That is, I need at least people to just know, to just at least say they know it. Okay? Because without these things, they're nothing. They're really nothing. So the primary motive of the Yud Gimel Ikarim, the 13 great Ikarim that everybody here, that has become so sanctified in Judaism, and maybe we'll talk about that, is probably a result of that. I want them to have a basic kind of two-page primer, right? But here he says these lower-level type people are confined to accepting tradition with regard to all sound opinions and are of such a short sort that it is preferable that they should be pronounced true with regard to all representations of this kind. So this is the lowest level. They're satisfied with simply, my father told me, and I have no desire that this is it. That's when he goes through various levels, that's at the very bottom of the list. When, however, a man grows perfect, and the mysteries of the Torah are communicating to him, he attains a rank at which he pronounces the above-mentioned correct opinions to be true. And in order to arrive at this conclusion, he uses veritable methods, namely demonstration, in cases where demonstration is possible, or strong arguments where this is possible. In this way, he represents to himself these matters, which had appeared to him as imaginings and imparables in their truth. That is, before, when he started off as a kid, Midrash, Torah, not Midrash, Torah. The Torah speaks, Midrash picks up on the language of the Torah. That is, the Torah speaks in parabolic language. And we'll get to that. However, all I'm saying is that the very first mitzvah, let me put out something more startling. That is, there was a book recently that was written by Mark Shapiro that you've had a number of times, at Torah in Motion, who wrote a book that caused a stir, and he's a great book. I think it's called Limits of Jewish Orthodoxy or something. Right. Whatever. So what the point of the book is that he goes through the Yud Gimel Ikrim, the very, you know, the sanctified Yud Gimel Ikrim. Don't forget, 13 principles that only arose in the 12th century. Judaism, as far as I know, started a long time before that. So nowhere in the entire Gemara will you find someplace. Okay, I know somebody's going to tell me here, and that's why he put the Yud Gimel Ikrim where he did. That says this is what you must believe, unlike Christianity and unlike Islam. You can go through the entire Gemara and be a Baki B'Shas, and somebody can ask you, what do I have to believe? And you won't be able to tell me. So in the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin, Perek Chelek they call it, where it goes through, these are the people that don't have a place in the Olam Haba, it gives you a few things. But even there, not to believe. One who says that Tchiyat HaMeitim, for instance, one who says that resurrection is not rooted in the Torah, Ein lo chelek l'olam haba. Now, so the Rambam found a place. By the way, Yud Gimel Ikrim, right? I mean, this is, like, to me, it's so astounding, right? The thing that's supposed to be the very basis of our faith. First of all, I would bet that most people, including yeshiva guys, can't even tell you what they are. All 13. Can't even tell you what they are. Not only that, but can't even tell you where the Rambam wrote them. Can't even tell you what language he wrote them in. So most people will tell me, where do we know the Yud Gimel Ikrim from? The Siddur. So, you know the Animamins? Animamin. The Rambam didn't write those. That's not the Rambam. Yigdal? It's over 14, nobody knows, but probably a early 14th century Italian. That's what the scholars seem to think. What? Or a cousin. By the way, this is interesting. Even the very phenomena that it gets into the Siddur is interesting. Why does something get into a Siddur? Now, the liturgy, of course, okay, it becomes standardized. There's differences here and there between Minhagim and Sephardic, but basically, there's a kind of standardized liturgy. Why does the Animamins, we don't pray it. I don't know, in my minion we don't say Animamin. It's at the end, but we don't say it. There is a bit of difference, by the way, between Sephardic Nuskhaot and our Nuskhaot of Mam, but we don't say it. Why does it get into the Siddur?
The people who come late and they're
right. So they can capture it all by just... Right. It's a function. Siddurim get published after the printing press. A lot of stuff is a function of the printing press, and what gets in or what's left out in books. What's that?
What has mass appeal?
Siddurim are printed.
The Yiddish expression,
a bachar adetzer. Right. But Siddurim are printed and published. Publishers publish books, including holy books. For what reason?
To sell them.
Okay. So you want to sell books. Okay, they're holy books. You probably consult the rabbis what should go into this Siddur. But why does the Animamin get in there?
Because
So we're not quite sure why, but I suspect that the Animamins got in there as a function of publishers' decisions, businessmen who maybe who were funding Sidurim, got together and, like in any publishing decision, decided, what should we put in the Siddur? Yeah, okay, we consulted the Rabbanim, we talked about what should go in the Siddur, the Shemoneh Esrei is right, everything's right, follows the right order. We've got to spice it up a little bit. Here I'm being a little bit, I don't know. I'm not sure. Nobody really knows. But I suspect that this is the case. Let's spice it up a little bit. Boy, you know, davening is boring. Maybe they could, you know, people come in with their books to read during davening. So let's give them something to read or something to think about while they daven so they can flip over to it. I suspect that's probably why the Animamins got in there. So again, most people don't know what they are. Most people don't know where they are in the Rambam. Most people know them through the Animamins, which weren't written by the Rambam. And by the way, they're a kind of sanitized version of the Rambam. That is, all the philosophical stuff that's in the original has been taken out. Animamin is not in the Rambam's original. We have translations that have Lahamin, but they're not probably the original translation. Is not Lahamin. One second. Each one is introduced by a word that has become very familiar in the modern consciousness. That is the word for principle, is Al-Qaeda. 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 That's the word that he uses. So everybody knows Al-Qaeda because it means the foundation, the principle, right? Which is here, Yisod HaYisodot, Amor HaChachmot, which is the kind of the Hebrew translation of what he thinks these Ikarim are. So Shapiro wrote a very nice book, but I don't even need his book to tell me, just by the phenomena of what I'm telling you, is already tells you that these Yud Gimel Ikarim, you know, are not necessarily what they're made out to be. However, what I wanted to tell you, why I mentioned Mark Shapiro, is that he goes through the various Ikarim and he shows how there were debates, like in any halachic debate. And by the way, make no mistake, this is a halachic debate. That is, the Rambam says that one who does not believe, and this is probably the most radical thing that he ever did, I think. That is, one who does not believe in these Yud Gimel Ikarim is not a Jew.
By what right did he have to say that?
Okay, you're right. By what right did he have to say that? By what right did he have? As far as I know, halachically, there's only one requirement for a Jew. To be a Jew.
He didn't say you're not Jewish. He said you lose your share in the world.
And
you're not considered part of
the You're not part of Klal Yisrael. Because
that doesn't mean you're not Jewish.
No, you're not part of Klal Yisrael.
Historical need at the
time? I'm not saying, okay, you're right. Halachically, I think the Rambam would agree. But he says you're not part of Klal Yisrael.
Correct.
Wasn't it a historical need, given what was going on at the time, to be so and
okay, there's a historic need, and there's a real need. Let me get to that in a second, but just Rabbi Kelman. So, you're right, because he's very well aware of the halakha.
But you're not part of Klal Yisrael.
But you're not part of Klal Yisrael. Okay, to me that translates into that translates into you're not Jew.
Okay.
Halachically, you're a Jew. Okay, halachically, if you're born of a Jewish mother, that's pretty well, any rabbinic decisor will tell you, that's all you need. Was he born of a Jewish mother? Sarkozy, who's running in France, right, for the president, who may very well become the president of France, is Jewish. He's actually Jewish. His mother was the daughter of of Jews who converted, Greek Jews who converted to Catholicism. So a rabbinic decisor would look at him and wouldn't say, what do you believe in, right? Do you believe in the Yud Gimel Ikarim? He wouldn't say that. He would say, your mother was Jewish? I don't even care whether your grandparents converted. Your grandparents converted, they were Jewish, the mother was Jewish, you're Jewish. You're halachically Jewish. You don't have to go through a conversion process. You don't have to have a bris. I don't know 100% the Kozi Dago, but just from what I read. No. It's okay. So again, this is what I'm trying to dispel. The Rambam has no leap of faith in his system. It's not a leap of faith. Again, I'm not dismissing that model. Right? I'm not, somebody said existentialism. That's not the Rambam's model. Okay, you know what? I can never say something is not with the Rambam. So maybe there's some give there. But by and large, that's not the Rambam's model. So just to go back to my point, that is, if I were to write a book, and I'm jealous because Mark Spiro wrote this book, I would go even further. That is, what he set out to show is that virtually for every principle, there's been a halachic debate as to whether this is, you know, an ikar or not, except for the first two, which is God exists and God is one. I would go further, and I would say that given what I've told you, and I'm going to try and still build this up, that virtually nobody, that though everybody would agree that God exists and God is one, is something we all believe in, nobody. Certainly not in yeshiva world, believes in the first two Ikarim of the Rambam. They pay lip service to it.
In the way he meant it.
They pay lip service to it because what he means by God exists is what I've been trying to convey here. God exists doesn't mean to say God exists. It doesn't mean to accept God exists because my father told me. That's a form of knowledge, but it's a very, very low level of knowledge. It means to go through everything that has to be gone through in terms of the curriculum that I mentioned last week of what he said he put his student through in order to get to the point where I know these things.
But isn't the irony that he goes through more than those, he goes through those 25 principles, he goes through all the spheres and what's in the spheres and who's controlling the spheres, and it was all wrong.
But again, I don't think that's all that important. I think today, he could easily still, right? He could easily say, okay, maybe Kant was right. I can't prove demonstrably that God exists. But I can get to the point as far as possible. I think he still would agree that the only way I could get to God is through his creation. All I know about God is what he's given us. He's given us the material. It's a product of him. If you use that principle, and the principles which he says many times, that is, knowledge is only real knowledge if I've demonstrated it to myself, if I've done the work. Knowledge is not knowledge if I say it. Knowledge is not knowledge if somebody has said it to me, even a man of great stature. Knowledge is only knowledge if I've actually proven it to myself. So I think those things still hold very much. So the irony, maybe an irony that the science was wrong, but I think the more importantly, the basic framework which he used is still relevant, is still pertinent. I don't think he would have to disavow whatever he said. Here and there, tinker with it, certainly, but not disavow. He wouldn't have to disavow the method. Yeah.
But is he basically pointing towards a messianic world? In other words, is this whole approach pointing towards the ideal man, the ideal world? In other words, after the resurrection, what we do is sit around, like the whole world essentially comes into a new era.
Right.
We're not like flying around on clouds, we're actually continuing in
right.
the process.
Right. Well, he's not flying, I don't think he's flying around in clouds either. He's very...
very rooted, but I guess...
Okay.
Messianic,
this leads me to another topic. However, it is, you raise a very interesting point. That is, the entire Mishneh Torah is framed on one end and on the other end by the knowledge of God. As you mentioned, that is, he starts with, it's very, very, in literary terms, an inclusio. You often are able in biblical studies to see kind of a portion of the Torah by noticing a kind of bracketing where it starts with similar with the word terms and it ends with a similar term, and you know that there's a unit here. The entire Mishneh Torah starts with Yesod Yesod Avamonah Chachmot Leida,
And it ends with also Leda. That is, just apropos your question, if you look at the second page of the handout I gave you last week, it may turn out that we never get past that first handout, but so be it. It means that you got to bring me back. So the Rambam, at the very last source in page 2 of that first handout, brings up what you said. Uba'oto hazman, meaning messianic. I hate the word used, messianic. Because the Mashiach for the Rambam, as you probably know, he's gotten really a bad rap because he's just the wrong guy to use. I don't know why he's like, you can use so many other guys, but because the Rambam is so powerful, everybody wants to use him, right? But he's just on this thing, Chabad, you mentioned. I don't want to attack Chabad, and I don't want to. He's just the wrong guy. He's the wrong guy. He's the wrong guy. When we use the term messianism today, it conjures up all kinds of things that the Rambam would have vomited if you heard that he stood for it. So I'll just give you. One sentence, right? There's no difference between this world and the messianic world, except Shibud Malchut. And he picks up on one. By the way, there are all kinds of differences of opinion in Judaism. Just to give you an idea, Mashiach is an Ikar, or the world to come is an Ikar. There's all kinds of debates about what Mashiach is. We don't even know what Mashiach is. The Christians have a very definite idea of what Messiah is. First coming, second coming, whatever you want to say. We don't. But the Rambam picks up on just one opinion and says there's no difference. It's a natural world. There's a natural historical progression to what we call the Messianic times. Messianic period is simply a name we give to a time to which we have historically progressed, where there will be world peace, a political change in the world, and a recognition by all people of what the truth, not what the truth is, but what the truth is that we should all pursue. Not a recognition that Judaism is the correct religion. That's right. Not a recognition that the Jews are the be-all and end-all. In effect, I would say...
We're Jews. And you might have a Mashiach, non-Jews will continue to be non-Jews.
That's right. But in effect, everybody will become Jews in a sense.
Everybody will understand God.
That's right.
There's a God.
Everybody will do that which is Yesod HaYesod HaTalmud HaChokhmah, which
right.
is what the Jews are all about too, except we have a certain message, we have a certain legal framework. However, Uba'otozman, so let's say we progress towards that point. Uba'otozman, this is the last source in that second page. Lo yesham lo ra'av lo milchama. Right, so this is a hippy-dippy kind of vision of, we'll all be brothers. Lo kina v'tachrut, lo jealousy and no competition. Sha'tova tiyeh mushpat harba. V'kol ha'madan, okay. V'lo yeh esek kol olam. Ella, what I started with. If you go back to you've made it here. I've always talked about this. I've never talked about anything different. In fact, I've never talked about, when I talk about the halakhot of Eruvin, when I talk about the halakhot of Shemitah, I've never, ever lost sight of what I started to talk about. So what I talk about is the entire world will be engaged in the Ladat et Hashem Bilvad, the same thing I started off with, to know God. Ulefichach yu Yisrael chachamim begdolim biyodim dvarim hastumim biyasigu dat barom kfikot. Okay. The whole world will be engaged in one enterprise. That's why, by the way, there'll be peace. There won't be some miraculous peace. It's when everybody is in the same business. Everybody's partners in the same business. And everybody has the same goal. Ipso facto, there'll be peace.
There'll be no other activity but the pursuit of...
There'll be other activity. He says, he makes a point. He makes a point of saying that nothing will change. Therefore, people will have to earn a living. Money won't grow on trees. All these things that we hear about, the lion will lie down with the lamb, are all metaphors.
So there'll still be competition, but there won't be jealousy.
No, there won't be competition. He says, lo tacharut. Okay. There won't be competition because everybody's engaged in the same... There's no competition. Competition only arises when I want to be better than you. There won't be that motivation. There won't be a motivation. Why would I want to be better than you? You're doing the same thing that I am. I don't want to show you that I'm better than you. I don't want to make more money than you. I don't want to use more knowledge than you have to get the better of you.
So there'll be no material aspirations.
No material aspirations, exactly, right? No material aspirations, because
but
material aspirations.
Material.
But they'll be material. That is, nothing will change, essentially, about the natural world. In fact, to me...
Philosophical coil.
I feel right. The Mashiach stands for something that is totally the opposite of what has become to stand for. The rallying call of the Rambam, which he associates with the Mashiach, Olam kiminhago noheg. That is, the Mashiach will be the time, in fact, where I recognize most the principle that I always should have recognized. That nature runs its natural course. That's the time that everybody will recognize that. That's the time we'll recognize that God doesn't come in to the universe, that God doesn't tell me and speak to me, that God doesn't involve himself all that. Okay, I'm running ahead a bit of myself. I'm being a little bit... However, the only way I come to know God is by... understanding the principle of Olam Kminhago Noheg, understanding the principle that he's given us something, which is the world and which is nature. And it is through that I know him. The Mashiach is the ultimate time when I know that nature is that which brings me. So in fact, it's completely the opposite of what is the common notion of messianism out there.
In a sense, what happened is, and I agree, of course, and that is the view of the Rambam, the world is normal. But as I once heard, I think it was Vera Wine who mentioned that with all the suffering of Jewish history for so many years, the Jewish masses couldn't conceive of the Mashiach as the world just as is. So they bought into the other views of the Mashiach,
right,
where the world is
right,
the unnatural,
right,
coming of the Mashiach.
Right. So I agree with you. There's all kinds of criteria that go, historical criteria, suffering,
galut. The Rambam, of course, is the total opposite of what we have.
But on the other hand, we also have to, I mean, though the Rambam may have lived, the Rambam's life was not a happy life either. It was not a happy life. It was marked by a lot of suffering, by wandering around, the death of his brother. We have a letter, actually, when his brother died, where he literally, if a psychiatrist were to look at the letter, he would say that the Rambam sunk into he had well he had yeah I mean we know of one son. He may have had women. We don't know much about, okay, so we don't even know, by the way, I was telling Larry the other day, we don't even know the women in his life. He may have had a daughter. We may have been married twice, actually. Avram he had quite late in his life, about when he was about 50 years old, towards the end of the 1180s he had Avram. So we know of Avram, but we don't know even the name of his wife. We don't even know what his wife's name was. So he led a very, very difficult life, and still he subscribed to the system. So I'm not sure you can. No, you're right. You're right. But it's not all comprehensive. That is, it's not sufficient to tell me that it's the gullus. But you're right. You're right. I mean, one could say,
many people just didn't want to accept the Rambam.
Right.
They looked for other views.
Right. I mean, one could say that the entire notion of, if I was just a scholar, okay, let's separate myself here from, but the entire notion of another world, of an Olam Haba, or of an Neshama that lasts after the body is dead, you have really, I'm not going to say here none whatsoever, but in the entire Tanakh, we have really no notion of something that outlives the body. Now, I've already lost my chelik and olhava maybe here, but from a literal point of view, you have something where kind of, you know, a couple of cases, Shoal brings up Shmuel, so Shmuel's hanging around somewhere, I don't know, right?
And the fact that it's not there.
No, I didn't say that. What I wanted to say was, apropos your comment, that is, the whole notion of an Olam Haba and another world may have also, according to scholars, come about as a result of suffering and gullus. That is, if you look at the Torah, it's pretty concrete. There is a theological causality. You look, we read it every day. V'hayim shamayet is right. If you listen, this will happen. Your crops will grow. The rain will come. After a while, especially you're living there in the first century and your temple has been destroyed and you've been enslaved and you can't find any real reason, you know, what did you do, cross the road against the red light, basically, right? But, you know, you've kept Shabbos, you've done all the things that you need to do, and your entire center of gravity has been destroyed. Some of the scholars would say exactly what you said about Mashiach, that the whole concept came about, you know what, it doesn't work in this world, I got to figure out something.
There's always historical motivations why certain things that were always true become at the forefront.
Right.
Absolutely. The message of the Torah is this. The Torah is this world-centered.
Right.
So for a variety of reasons that we don't have time to get into,
right.
The Torah doesn't focus on the next world.
Right.
But it was a yesod that it existed. Therefore, at certain times in our history, when this world was really bad, so we started focusing on the next world.
Right.
So the historical circumstances caused by something which is very latent and not really... The main focus is toward this world,
right.
But to give hope to Jews in despair, we can talk about the next
right,
world.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
So it's not a contradiction. It's just a historical
right.
Place.
Right. So there are historical reasons, but again, just by those historical reasons, all I was trying to say is that the Rambam himself suffered immensely during his life. He was sick. He lost his brother. I was like, okay, this letter says he didn't get out of bed for a year. Now that's serious depression. Clinical depression. He may have sunk into clinical depression. I mean, his brother, by the way, who was a businessman,
supported him.
He talks about how his brother was a bucky. He learned everything he had to learn from his brother. His brother was a grammarian. We're not talking here about, you know, some guy was a CEO and, you know, he was a sucker and zvulun kind of thing. He learned with his brother. His brother taught him things. It Torah, right? And he was a businessman. But he suffered. Sorry, you were going to...
Yeah. I think you hit it, that the Mashiach is no question. Chiyat HaMeitim, I don't know. But Olam Haba, in those last few chapters in Melachim, he says, don't speculate too much. We don't
right,
know what
don't, right,
Haba.
Exactly,
so
exactly.
He's really honest. He really...
Right.
And disagree with...
By the way, we have to separate between Olam Haba and Mashiach, Chiyat HaMeitim. All these things are so vague. Here's another thing. Here are principles. Right? Principles, Mashiach. Let me ask you something. Olam Haba, does it become... Where is Olam Haba? Mashiach, Olam Haba, Chiyat
HaMeitim,
Gan Eden. Where? What? You know, we're so... I mean, it all goes back to... I mean, Malcolm Kellner wrote this book, The Jews Have to Believe in Anything, that really the Rambam introduced something that probably was... foreign, that is that the importance of belief, and to this day people pay lip service to it, but they don't conduct their Jewish lives by it. I don't think by and large Judaism is still well, we can talk about that.
that's become
right. Yeah.
Okay, so if I'm grasping, essentially, all of these Mashiach concepts imply a transmutation or transformation of human consciousness rather than any transformation of physical realities and natural laws. It's the consciousness that must change. Is that correct?
Okay, I my background is in philosophy, and terms that people use when you say consciousness... There's so much baggage to that term that I don't want to say I agree to that. There's a conscious effort or a conscious knowledge of what is worthwhile to pursue. Consciousness, though, now has a lot of baggage in terms of New Age movements and mysticism, and that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about rational consciousness. That is, there'll be a time... And this is a progression, so that if somebody tells me that that Mashiach is coming tomorrow because the world is in such bad shape, it doesn't make sense. because for the Rambam, if it's a historical progression, it means that I'll know when Mashiach is coming.
Yeah,
because it means we're getting closer and closer. Yeah, there is. There is. But let's leave that for a moment. So consciousness, not mystical consciousness, not New Age consciousness.
Right. But all of the discussions around this point are semantical and linguistic dialectics.
Let me just end the class because it's at 11, right? So I just want to end with one more source, just to end up, and we'll continue with this next week. I'm building up this argument about the halakhic obligation to study science, to study philosophy. Here, I think I'm going to put a little bit more, make this a little bit stronger. So if you look at the hand that I gave today, and the first source there, which is Hilchot Talmud Torah. Notice this. This is remarkable. This is remarkable. A lot of people miss this, but it's quite remarkable, the move that the Rambam makes here. Picks up on standard rabbinic fare. This is in the Gemara. Chayav l'shalesh etzman l'midato. That is, a person's curriculum, daily schedule, should be divided three-part division. Shlish b'tor shebal peh, a third. Sorry, shlish b'tor shebetav, a third Tanakh. Shlish b'tor shebal peh, a third oral law. V'shlish, now listen to this. Yavin v'yaskil achrit davar mereshito. One should be well versed in the method, the deductive method, right, of deriving something from its, right, one thing from another, making inferences. V'yadame davar l'davar, be able to make proper analogies. V'yavin b'midot shehatorah nidreshet b'hen, understand those yud gimel midot, right, yud gimel, I don't know, right, yigdal, by the way, yigdal, you know, it's 13, yud gimel, right, yigdal. Yud gimel for the dal, I would think, for the one who is low. There's 13. This will raise you up. However, you know the 13, so halachic. Know the 13, but some of these things are logical tools. You know, arguments. A fortiori arguments, kal v'chomer, analogies, right? Klal u'prat, these things. Atchiyadahehu ikara midot behech yotze, how you derive isur and mutar. And also things that we've been handed down, right? That is oral law that was also handed down. Is a difficult term, but let's say handed down right from Sinai. Gemara. Not enough. Wait. Okay. This is called Gemara. Divide your time. He picks up on a Gemara. Three parts. But we already have an inkling, right? To know how to reason, right? Now look at Halacha Yud Beit. Ketzad haya bala umanut vaya osek b'lapdo shla. So now he's going to give you the practical. Umanut, right, umanut. Otana tesha korbish. Okay, so now. You lose a third in the Torah Shabbatav, a third in Torah Shabbatav, u'bishalosh achirot, in the last third, this is important. Mitbonein b'da'ato lahavin davar midavar. Understand to his own knowledge how, again, this is philosophy. This is logic. Bamed var mamurim b'tchilat. Sorry, this is important. B'divrei kabbalah. So the last third, divrei kabbalah b'chlal torah shebiktav v'hein perushin b'chlal torah shebalpeh v'ha'inyanim hanikraim pardes b'chlal hagmarahein. That which is called pardes, and I'm going to whet your appetite because we'll pick up on this next week, is called Gemara. So let's leave it there, okay, and next week we'll talk about what Pardes is. But he adds something here that is very important. That is something that man should ultimately only occupy himself, which is Gemara. I think most yeshiva guys would agree with me on that, but most yeshiva guys will not agree with me on what the Rambam means by Gemara. And what the Rambam means by ultimately the main part of Gemara learning. So I have to leave you all with kind of leave hanging, but next week we'll talk about what Pardes means.